You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report shows that more and more people in the U.S. are being infected with superbugs. We'll talk with a doctor about why that is and what we can do to protect ourselves from antibiotic-resistant diseases. Now, the 2020 census is about 6 months away, and in Wisconsin, there's new attention on how prisoners get counted. For people incarcerated in Wisconsin, their residence is considered the place where the prison is located. Critics say that amounts to prison gerrymandering, taking resources and representation that belong where the prisoners lived before, often urban centers, and shifting it to less populated rural parts of the state. Ivan Moreno is the Milwaukee correspondent for the Associated Press. He wrote about this. Ivan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, spell it out a little more for us, how the census counts people who are currently incarcerated.
Well, I mean, it's just like you described. Basically, since 1850, the census has had this policy that prisoners are residents of prisons because they fit the definition of their definition of residence, which is where someone sleeps or lives most of the time, regardless of their previous legal residence. So it's been happening for about 170 years, but not really gotten much attention because, you know, the prison population didn't really used to be that big back then. And now in the last couple of decades, of course, we saw an explosion in incarceration rates. And now we're seeing how including prisoners as residents of prisons, how what kind of impact that has when it comes to redistricting and other things.
What are critics saying about the impact this has on the way things like funding and political representation are sent out?
Well, so with political representation, just to give you one example, there were two professors of Villanova University in Pennsylvania that did this study where they took all of the black prisoners around the state and moved them to their prior home in where they lived in Pennsylvania. And what that did is it basically made the districts, and these are statehouse districts, by the way, it made them too big. It exceeded the legal limit for them. So it would have essentially created what they said, at least one more minority majority district. So what this does is when you put prisoners as residents of these rural areas, they essentially inflate the power of the places where they're in prison. And as you know, and as everyone knows, prisons are usually located in rural white Republican areas. So it's basically you're seeing a shifting of power from these urban centers to these more rural communities.
And local population numbers, as judged by the census, can affect different kinds of funding, as I understand it, from state and especially federal governments. Is this enough of a difference that it might influence where money flows?
Yeah, it does impact that, but it's hard to quantify how much of an impact that would have because, you know, there's a lot of different programs and block grants. And of course, some of these towns that house these prisons do legitimately need some aid for like road maintenance, depending on obviously the number of visitors that they get there. But yeah, when you have an undercount of a community and you have programs that disperse money based on a population count, that inevitably reduces the type of aid that they get.
Talking to Ivan Moreno from the Associated Press, the census is just around the corner, and some in Wisconsin, including state lawmakers, are worried about the impact that counting prison inmates as residents of the place where the prison is instead of where they're from can skew things like how we set up our political voting districts. Ivan, you write that there are some state lawmakers who are introducing legislation to try to change that. What are they looking at?
Well, here in Wisconsin, what the pending bill would do is it says that prisoners should be counted as residents of where they were living before they were imprisoned. That's essentially what the bill does. The Speaker of the House is against the bill, so it's pretty safe to say that the bill probably won't go anywhere. This is not just a Wisconsin issue. You have this happening all over the country where states that are controlled by Democrats are passing or proposing legislation to try to make this change. And in fact, there are now six states that forbid counting prisoners as part of a legislative district. New York and Maryland were the first to do that in 2010. And since then, there have been other four other states, the most recently Washington State and Nevada.
The census is required by the U.S. Constitution. It's run by the U.S. Census Bureau. States get to do this. They get to decide where certain people get counted.
To some extent, what the census did in 2010 is they released this data that they referred to as group quarters, which that would include like dorm rooms and prisons, to help in the case of Maryland and New York be able to move the prisoners to their pre-incarceration address. It could be obviously a tedious, long process, but at the end of the day, these states know when someone gets in prison, they know where they used to live. The census is responsible for counting, but they have nothing to do with redistricting. That they leave up to the states.
You talk to some people who are critics of the critics, people who say, no, the way it's working is fine. What were their arguments?
Well, I spoke with a lawmaker in Arizona, and he represents a district that is two-thirds are inmates. So the population there is about 30,000. His argument to me was what I referenced earlier is that these communities incur costs as a result of having a prison there, whether it's emergency services or road maintenance. And he also brought up this kind of counterpoint that this is no different than how the census counts people who are in the country illegally. They are counted as residents of where they live, even though they can't vote, just like the prisoners can't vote while they're incarcerated. And he sees no problem with that. And so he called it the census as a snapshot in time and sees the system as so far working the way that it should.
Ivan, as we wrap up, you mentioned that this legislation probably won't go anywhere in the state legislature. The census isn't going to probably change this. So at least here in Wisconsin, it's going to work the same this time as it did last time. Is that right?
Well, unless Democrats manage to get control of both chambers of the legislature in November, then they could pass this legislation and it wouldn't be too late for them to do something different the next time the redistricting process comes along in 2021. So, things could change if Democrats take control.
Ivan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Ivan Moreno, the AP's Milwaukee correspondent. He was with us today to talk about his latest story on the political fight over how to count prison inmates in the 2020 census. Coming up, home field advantage is one of the great variables in the world of sports. We'll talk with a guest who's crunched the numbers to find out if it exists, and if so, what causes it. Get the answers coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll find out what the numbers say about home field advantage in sports and why crowd noise might not be as disruptive for visiting teams as we might think. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about writing.
Every author has their own way of writing. They get in the zone, channel their creativity, and then words start flowing onto the page or computer screen. There's a writer in Madison that does this by writing in Morse code, moving his head side to side as he hits sensors. Author Stephen Salmon shares his experience of being a professional writer with cerebral palsy, all while living in a group home. He calls this story The Tapping Author, and it's read by Norman Gilliland.
I sit in my manual wheelchair in front of the computer, swaying my head back and forth, tapping Morse code. Every 5 seconds, another letter appears on the computer screen. Time keeps moving as letters turn into words, becoming sentences, paragraphs, pages, chapters, and eventually novels. I'm in the writing zone, concentrating on the process of creating, when one of my care attendants walks up to me, asking, "What do you want to eat for supper?" I told you what I wanted 3 hours ago. A hamburger, a potato, and salad with dressing, I say, as I stop writing to answer her. "Okay, thanks," the attendant tells me, leaving the green and gold Packers office. I resume writing when the attendant returns to ask, "What do you want on your burger?" I looked at the time. It's 3 o'clock. "Why?" "I'm busy and I want to make it now," she says, waiting for my reply. I sigh before answering, "Ketchup, mustard, and pickles." She goes out of the office while I continue to write. A minute later, she comes back saying, "You don't have any dressing." "Use vinegar. Don't bother me. I'm working," I reply, feeling upset, not having what I want, but I'm focused on the manuscript. Often I go without things that I need or want. After taking a couple of minutes, I regain my thoughts, getting back to my writing, when my roommate, who thinks we're in a relationship, says, "Hello, my friend. Can I have your ice cream?" After taking a deep breath, I ignore her while trying to write. A moment passes. The words flow from my mind onto the page. That's my life living in a group home. Writing is like breathing to me. I sit there lost in my newest manuscript, making a vision come to life for a reader. I tap my second language of Morse code and write and communicate with people. It reminds me of my dad, who was a ham radio operator. He taught me how to spell my name in Morse code. When I was 24, an occupational therapist at the Wiseman Center introduced me to the Morse code program called Derek. I spelled out one letter at a time. I'm writing in a constant rhythmic pace, now remembering the occupational therapist saying, "Steve, it amazes me that you learned Morse code in 2 weeks and now you're writing paragraphs." I'm in the middle of writing a manuscript for my literary agent, and I need a computer to write a New York Times bestseller, I said, swaying my head, tapping away. Time moves fast while I write. It seems like nothing can stop me as I lose myself in the story. "Hey, Steve, your food is ready, and at 6, the PM care attendant says, entering my office. "Oh, give me 5 minutes, I tell the attendant. Time is like writing. It changes and flows onward through new challenges. Life is short. The tapping is always in my mind, writing the next page or manuscript. For now, I'm tired and hungry. I call, "I want to eat." "Coming."
That story from author Stephen Salmon was read by WPR's Norman Gilliland. Salmon lives in Madison and has written multiple books, including his newest release, It's a New Life, Mom is Gone. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, one of the best things about cheering your favorite sports teams on in person is the feeling that you're helping them defend their turf and being part of the infamous home field advantage. But anyone who watched this year's World Series knows that it only goes so far. The visiting team won every matchup in the 7-game series. Our next guest looked into the numbers behind home field advantage and found that while there's a benefit to playing at home, the reasons might not be what we think. Kostas Pelikrinis is an associate professor of computing and information at the University of Pittsburgh. Kostas, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad I'm talking to you. Thanks for having me.
What made you want to look into the data behind home field advantage?
Yeah, home field is one of those things that we know it's there, but and because you can actually measure it with the data, but it's hard to identify its origins. So many, actually, of my friends were firm believers that fans have an impact on players of the opposing team. But for me, it just seemed that it's too far-fetched to believe that professional athletes that get millions, they will be impacted that much by some fans heckling on them. So that's why I try to see whether we can identify what are the reasons behind that. And, of course, other people have tried the same thing, too.
And let's talk about that heckling a little bit. You focus a lot in your work on basketball and the NBA, and there's an easy one to look at. If I'm shooting a free throw and everybody's yelling at me and hooting and hollering, does it make it harder for me to hit those free throws?
Yeah, exactly. So there are different things that actually you can look at and different in different sports. So as you said, one thing in basketball that you can look and we looked at was basically free throws. Free throws is a good example because basically it's kind of controlled. You always have the same distance. There is no one playing defense on you while you're shooting. So it's only you, the basket, and possibly the crowd. And we saw that there is no difference in the percentages of players that play at home and away. Other people have done similar things. For example, in the NFL, there was a nice article from 538 a year ago where basically they found that loud noise has no impact on the offense of a team. The false start penalties are the same rate for home and away teams, something that you wouldn't expect if noise was basically part of the equation here. So there are many, many ways to try and find that there is not really an impact on the actual skill, the actual performance of a player when they play home and away.
Well, now here's another part of the story. Every fan knows that the referees are biased against their team, whatever team it is. But you looked at whether referees were biased in general towards the home team in games. What did you find out?
Yeah, so actually that's one of the major reasons that you have the home field advantage. Many of the decisions that referees have to make are kind of subjective. So was it a blocking foul or was it a charge? It's kind of hard. It has some subjective knowledge, some subjective element there, the same as pass interference. So what we found, and other people also have found in other sports, is basically the home team gets, you know, all these 50-50, let's say, whistles. So, for example, home teams get about a foul more in NBA games. Other people have found that in NHL, teams get about one penalty more, which is about 0.25 goals more. In MLB, actually, at Scorecast, a nice book on the topic, actually found a report that when there's a full count, home teams usually get the right call in order to get this base. So it's actually pretty interesting. The data is very heavily skewed towards showing that home teams get some referee bias when it comes to subjective calls.
We need a psychologist on to talk about why that might be, but let's look at another reason, and this one seems pretty clear. If I'm on the road, I had to fly or drive a long way, I'm tired out from travel. Is the travel itself something that helps the home team and hurts the visiting team?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, there's a lot of research that goes back decades on that have shown clearly that, you know, jet lags and specific travel directions have a lot of impact on sports performance. So having to travel and then having to do back-to-back games when it comes to scheduling, for example, in the NBA, definitely this affects a lot the performance of teams.
You looked in a piece you wrote about this at whether home field advantage is changing over time. What did you find out?
Yeah, actually, there is a steady decline, not significant from year to year, but over the past decade, we are seeing a decline in the home field advantage. And actually, that's kind of expected if the major reasons are the ones that we just cited, because you expect, you know, traveling to become more easy as years have passed. It's easier to travel today as it was 30 years ago. It's more comfortable. And also, referee bias can be reduced to some extent using challenges. You know, have leagues have introduced all these means that allow teams basically to challenge decisions that might have been biased from the referees.
Interesting. So if the coaches can challenge the referees, or you get VAR in soccer, or whatever the replay mechanism is that actually reducing the amount of referee bias in favor of the home team?
Yeah, we haven't explicitly looked at that, but anecdote evidence seemed to point that way. So, for example, this year is the first season that the NBA has introduced the coaching challenges rule, and actually we had the first anecdote evidence in the game between Portland and Dallas, where the referee gave a foul for Dallas right 4 seconds before the end of the game that would most probably have Dallas won the game, but then the coaches challenged that, and they overturned it. So the home team didn't get the advantage that they would have otherwise.
As a sports fan yourself, Kostas, has crunching all these numbers changed the way you watch sports and your own favorite teams?
Yeah, definitely. It has changed. I think the major thing that now I understand better is how much luck is involved in winning. So I don't get that much upset when my team loses, because there is a lot of luck involved in sports.
That's a good lesson for all of us. Kostas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kostas Pelikrinis is an associate professor of computing and information at the University of Pittsburgh. He talked with us about what the data can tell us about home field advantage in the world of sports. Coming up, we'll look at what's behind the rise in the number of people infected with superbugs. These are diseases, fungal diseases, bacterial diseases that can be harmful, even deadly, but are gradually evolving a resistance to the most commonly used medications that are used to treat them. We'll talk to a doctor who's following the issue, has written a book about the efforts to contain these so-called superbugs. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at the latest on the impeachment inquiry and a preview of the second week of public testimony in the U.S. House. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, drug-resistant superbugs are becoming more and more of a problem in the United States. A new report says 2.8 million people are infected each year, killing 35,000. That's a substantial increase from about 5 years ago. Superbugs are bacteria and fungi that have developed resistance to common drugs, making them hard to treat. Some in the medical community are expressing great concern with the new figures. The news seems scary. The CDC does say there are ways the public can help prevent the spread of infections. Dr. Matt McCarthy is an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City and a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's the author of 3 books, including Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, which came out this spring. Dr. McCarthy, good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We have this new announcement from the CDC with these numbers raising the alarm bell some. The head of the CDC said, stop talking about we're going to come to a post-antibiotic era. We may already be there. What do you think of these statements from the CDC?
Well, I have mixed emotions. On the one hand, I'm glad that the CDC is getting out there and making people aware of just how big of a problem this is. But I don't at all envision us going to a post-antibiotic era. You know, one of the things I have focused my research and my writing on is all of the incredible things people are doing to address the rise of superbugs and how we're, you know, working to discover new antibiotics all the time. I think one of the things that people don't recognize is that the soil beneath our feet has all of these really interesting chemicals, and some of them can be plucked out of the earth and turned into antibiotics. And so I think the CDC announcement underscores the need for us to keep digging, literally, for more antibiotics.
Tell us a little more about what superbugs are. What do we mean by that word?
Yeah, it's a controversial term, actually. A superbug is generally any microbe that is resistant to treatment. And traditionally, we've thought of drug-resistant bacteria, but we know that the problem is far bigger than that. It also includes treatment-resistant fungi, parasites, and some would even say viruses. And if you put all of that together, the scope of this problem is tremendous. The World Health Organization says that by the year 2050, that 10 million people will die worldwide every year from superbugs. And this would make it a more pressing disease, the condition, than heart disease or cancer. And yet it doesn't get any of the airtime that these other conditions do. So I appreciate you shedding light on this topic that a lot of people could learn more about.
And a tricky thing about this is if I have a superbug and I have the symptoms of a particular disease, I don't know if it's a superbug or not, right? I don't know if it's antibiotic, say, resistant bacteria. My symptoms look the same whether or not it's treatable.
That's exactly right. You have no way of knowing. And that really puts the onus on the physicians to do a better job communicating with patients once we identify a superbug to explain to a patient, what does that mean? And a lot of times, you know, I was in the emergency room this morning seeing a patient with a superbug, and the questions that come up are, why did this happen to me? What can be done about it? And am I contagious? You know, am I going to spread this to a loved one? And those are things that we on the medical side need to do a much better job of explaining to people. And I think one of the important things for listeners to know is that if you're listening to this wondering if you might be at risk for superbugs, it's useful to check in with your doctor to ask how your immune system is. If you have a fully normally functioning immune system, you're probably not at very high risk. I walk into rooms all the time that are filled with superbugs, and they don't affect me. And when I go home at night, I'm not worried that I'm going to transmit those to my young children. But there are people who are on medications that weaken their immune system, or they have medical conditions that impair their immune system, and that puts them at high risk. And many of the people that I see and that I treat don't recognize that they were at high risk.
And that makes this tricky. And you wrote in one piece about this, what we might well have, I might well have something like MRSA, this one particular superbug, in my nostril right now, and it could well never affect my health at all.
That's exactly right. You know, we have these ways of keeping ourselves healthy. You know, our skin is a very powerful barrier. I could have MRSA on my skin and it causes no problem. But then if I slice my arm and the skin breaks and that MRSA slips inside the skin and gets to my blood, we've got a big problem. And so I counsel people on what to do if they are at high risk. You know, if you're somebody who's on high dose prednisone or you're getting chemotherapy, you don't want to walk into a moldy basement. You don't want to go into open water. There are ways of protecting yourself. I see people who have a cut on their leg and they have their cat or their dog lick the cut. And then the superbugs that are in the dog or cat's mouth get into the patient's bloodstream and wreak havoc. And that's one of the things I write about in my book, are all of these unusual ways that people can pick up superbugs.
Talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy. He's the author of the book Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. He's with us talking about a new announcement from the CDC about the urgency of dealing with these antibiotic, antifungal, and so on resistant diseases. Dr. McCarthy, how do we get these resistant diseases? Is this just evolution in action?
Well, what happens is we have misused antibiotics. Every time we expose the microbes to these precious chemicals, they figure out ways to mutate and to evolve. And so starting in the 1960s, we started picking up that the bacteria were developing these enzymes that could chop up antibiotics. And they were developing things called efflux pumps, which are like microscopic vacuum cleaners that suck up antibiotics and spit them out. And what happened was a lot of these mutations were occurring at a time when the pharmaceutical industry started focusing more on treating other more profitable conditions like cancer and like heart attacks. And so we've been playing catch up ever since. And so when I say that we overuse antibiotics, I mean that on the large scale, meaning we use them in commercial agriculture and then meat producing animals. We give syphilis and tuberculosis drugs to orange groves to protect the crops. And that produces superbugs in the soil. And that's sort of on the large scale. And then on the small scale, doctors like me occasionally prescribe antibiotics to people who don't need them. people who have a virus or that just have a common cold. And that does everyone a disservice because it allows the bacteria to mutate after being exposed to antibiotics unnecessarily. So really the first step here, I think, in response to the CDC's message is to educate people and to say, here's what's really going on. And more importantly, here's what we're doing about it.
Let's talk about health clinics and hospitals where a lot of germs come in and a lot of people who might have compromised immune systems come in. That sounds like a front line in the battle against superbugs. What do we need to be doing?
Yes. So one of the things that comes up a lot is how do we even talk to people about the places that do have superbugs? And, you know, we have to stress that we have containment protocols and protection measures that we use to prevent those superbugs from going from one patient to another. And sometimes those were called contact precautions. You know, I wear a gown when I go into most patients' rooms. I wear gloves. Sometimes I wear a face mask. And when we are on the front lines, we have to be very careful about what we wear and what we do. And, you know, sometimes that really freaks patients out. You know, they come into the emergency room with a fever. And next thing you know, there's this team of people walking in with moon suits and they feel really stigmatized. And so we're trying to figure out exactly what to wear in a way that protects people, but that doesn't scare them.
That reminds me, we've got this announcement from the CDC highlighting the urgency of treating superbugs. And I'm hearing urgency from you, but I'm not hearing panic. And I could see people hearing stuff about this and kind of freaking out about it.
Yeah, that's the, I think, one of the big messages is that we do not need to panic. I think one of the common narratives right now is that we are running out of antibiotics. That's actually not true. If you look, the FDA approves new antibiotics all the time. There was an antibiotic approved by the FDA last week. One of the challenges here is figuring out how to use them. And that's what my research and what my writing focuses on is that these pharmaceutical companies spend billions of dollars investing in these new drugs, and then they charge exorbitant amounts for their products because they need to make back their investment. And a lot of hospitals can't afford to carry these very expensive antibiotics. And so there becomes this situation where patients have superbugs where they're not necessarily being exposed to the best treatment or the newest treatment option simply because of cost. And so what I get very interested in is sort of how do you treat these infections in a way that's both cost effective and ethical. And so I think you're right. There are people who are panicking right now, and I am not one of them. You know, I spend my life treating superbugs, and the overwhelming feeling I have on this whole topic is optimism, that this is something where we've identified a challenge, people are becoming aware of it, and we're going to meet this crisis head on, and we're going to figure out a way to treat these things.
We're talking about the rise of superbugs. These are diseases that evolve basically immunities to the medications meant to treat them. Dr. Matt McCarthy is with us. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, and author of the book Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these so-called superbugs? Have you ever had one? Or do you have maybe a family member who has had to deal with that? Are you worried about being infected by one? Do you work in healthcare? What are you seeing and doing to prevent the spread of these kind of diseases? And what questions do you have about how things like antibiotics and antifungal and antiviral medications are used? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that shows superbug cases are becoming more numerous, more deadly. Dr. Matt McCarthy is our guest. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. His books include Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. He says, yes, this is a real problem. No, don't panic. Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join the conversation. Are you worried about superbugs? Do you have a question for our guest about what they are, how they've come to be, how they're treated and prevented? If you work in healthcare, what have you seen on this issue in your own practice? Have you changed the way you prescribe things like antibiotics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. The doctor made a very interesting comment considering that this is an election year, and I'll make a very interesting response to that comment. And that is that the doctor said that these new antibiotic drugs coming on the market are so expensive that hospitals cannot afford to buy them, to give them to the patients. But if I were an American living in Europe or visiting in Europe and got one of these super bugs, a hospital or a doctor there, because they don't pay as much for the drugs to begin with, I could be treated there, which is saying that an American life is hardly worth anything.
Nancy, thanks for the call. I know there are price discrepancies, Dr. McCarthy, in the U.S. and other countries for many medications. Does that include things like the newer antibiotics you were talking about?
It does. And I'll tell you, I feel so strongly about the price discrepancy issue that it's the topic that I focused and I framed my book around. My book is about a new antibiotic that hit the market 5 years ago that the companies were charging $4,000 a dose for. And my hospital, one of the best in the world, said, we can't afford to use that. And I convinced the company to give me some of the drug for free to show how important it would be for us to actually have this drug in our stock shelves. And that was sort of the animating idea for all the work that I do, which is just making new antibiotics accessible to people. And I completely agree that this is going to be a political issue, because there are people out there who are saying the pharmaceutical companies are losing interest in making new antibiotics. Well, good riddance. This should be something the federal government takes over, and that we should view antibiotics like a public good, like electricity or water. And that's something we're going to hear debated in 2020 and beyond, which is how far should our federal government go to ensure that there are treatments available for superbugs?
Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Kevin now in Keeler. Kevin, hello.
Good afternoon. Very interesting subject. First of all, I'd like to say I know someone who lost their vestibular system due to autotoxicity reaction to the drug gentamicin. That being said, and seeing all of these television commercials on during the nighttime evening programs with what I consider to be horrendous side effects, my question is, are we having to go down this road with all of these possibly terrible side effects to fight these bugs? Is that part of this new wave of drugs?
Kevin, thanks for the call. Dr. McCarthy, the side effects of antibiotics, new and old.
Yeah, Kevin, the opening scene of my book is a patient has a superbug, and the only antibiotic that will work is a drug called colistin. That's an antibiotic that we stopped using 20 years ago because it was so outrageously toxic, and it destroys the kidneys and other vital organs in the process. But we're increasingly bringing it back because it's one of the few drugs that we know work. And I'm on the ethics committee at my hospital, and I find myself facing these ethical dilemmas where I worry that these antibiotics that have tremendous side effects could actually be doing more harm to the patient than the infection itself. So I completely agree that the side effect issue is one that we are still trying to work out. Many of the newer antibiotics, the ones that are so fabulously expensive, are actually a little bit better tolerated. They have fewer side effects. So I think that Kevin hit on a really important point, which is that even when we come up with a drug that works, we got to make sure that it's actually safe.
Kevin, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy, author of the book Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, looking at a new announcement from the CDC about these antibiotic-resistant bacteria, other medicine-resistant diseases out there. They're becoming more common. They're killing more people over time, but Dr. McCarthy says there is hope out there. Jack joins us now in Eagle River. Jack, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Enjoy the show. I have a question of the product of hand sanitizers having influence on superbugs. I just would like the doctor's comment.
Yeah, so this, Jack, this comes up a lot with us, trying to figure out what do we use to keep our hands clean. It used to be antibacterial soaps, and then we found out that those were simply breeding superbugs. So the FDA came out a few years ago and said, you know what, just use regular old soap and water or ethanol-based hand sanitizers. And so we now, I often find myself using just like what I did 30 years ago, soap and water, just to protect myself and to make sure that we don't breed any of this resistance. The other area where we're still figuring things out is decontaminating rooms. After a patient has a superbug infection, we're testing all different types of chemicals to ensure that the room is fully clean as soon as before a new patient comes in.
Thanks a lot for that call. Are our personal hygiene choices when it comes to hand washing significant enough to make a difference in the spread of various kinds of superbugs?
Well, you know, what comes up a lot is people say to me, you know, what can I do? Because this is such a global problem. It's sometimes compared to things like climate change, where people feel like if other countries aren't pulling their weight, what's the point in a doctor, you know, being more stingy, prescribing antibiotics, or a patient not taking them unless they need them? And I think that it really comes down to the fact that we as Americans need to set the example for what should be done. You know, you can go to Mexico and buy antibiotics over the counter without a doctor's prescription. That's not the way we want things to be. And we want to show what the right way to do things is so that we're all on the same page. And I think if we can all act together, it will certainly curb the rise of superbugs. And that's going to be the goal for the next generation.
Let's bring on another caller now. Sarah is with us calling from Milwaukee. Sarah, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to call in. Now, this is about viruses, I understand, but my mother recently contracted West Nile encephalitis this last year from a mosquito or a tick. And I just wanted to talk about a little bit how these diseases are actually heading up north, which we never thought would be an issue, and how to maybe prevent some of these.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Dr. McCarthy, I don't know if West Nile has an antiviral treatment or not to become a superbug, but what do you know about the geographic spread there?
Well, Sarah, I'm sorry to hear about your mom. So West Nile is transmitted by a mosquito, and what we're finding is that both mosquitoes and ticks are changing their migratory patterns, and they're changing the diseases that they carry with them. The safest thing that you can do is during the summer months is to be very careful about going to places that are endemic with mosquitoes or doing tick checks after you go outside for the beach or going, you know, playing in the summer months. Things like Lyme disease, you have to have the tick on you for at least 24 hours for it to transmit Lyme. So if you check yourself every day, you're able to protect yourself. Things like West Nile don't really have a reliable treatment for them. You know, it is a virus, as she mentioned, and the goal right now is really preventative rather than treatment. And it can often be very hard to even make the diagnosis. We see West Nile a good amount here in New York, but, you know, other parts of the country, it's very rare. So a big part of it is just education about prevention.
Sarah, thanks a lot for sharing your mom's story there. Dr. McCarthy, in our last few moments, you have hope on the horizon here when it comes to superbugs.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the coolest part of this whole story is that we're now using artificial intelligence to search through just tons and tons of dirt. And the other place we're starting to look is the bottom of the ocean. And what we're doing is we're looking for chemicals that resemble the antibiotics that we know and use right now, but that are slightly different. And what we're figuring out are ways to very quickly sift through all of this material to find the most promising chemicals. And then from there, we start doing tests in test tubes and in animals and then healthy human volunteers. And so I can tell you that most of my conversations with people about superbugs are actually filled with hope and optimism. It's people who've just discovered a new antibiotic or who have just figured out a way to cure someone. And it's not a doomsday scenario from where I stand. You know, every single day I go into the emergency room and I help people to understand how they may have contracted an infection. And I think the best part of this is getting to, you know, see the human side of these conditions.
Dr. McCarthy, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Matt McCarthy. His latest book is Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. We talked with him about a new CDC report showing that superbugs are infecting and killing more people in the United States. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a state lawmaker joins the show with a plan to help rebuild wetlands in urban parts of Wisconsin. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate talks to a Nobel Prize-winning economist about her work on global poverty. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the new podcast, Bookmarks, from our own To the Best of Our Knowledge, stories of how books have changed the lives of authors and other creative types. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.